This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
Hi, Dr. Bull. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to chat with you. We've made it through some technical difficulties, hopefully. So here we go. I would love to just start out with you just describing your journey to naturopathy and how you ended up in LA.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm really grateful for the invitation to be here. Just small kind correction, and that is really important that we talk about naturopathic medicine versus naturopathy. And you'll hear me reference myself as a naturopathic doctor or a licensed naturopathic doctor. And it's not out of vanity, but really a necessity as just to delineate the traditional naturopaths from those of us with an actual medical license. Those lay naturopaths or traditional naturopaths, I think they're very well-intentioned people. I think they're helping a lot of people in their own ways, but they do not have a medical license. They cannot physically examine patients, make clinical diagnoses, or treat those diagnoses. And I think most of them are certificate programs and not, you know, this four-year doctorate level program that enables myself and other licensees to actually be licensed to practice naturopathic medicine. So that's just my little tidbit there. Thank you for allowing me that. So I found my way to naturopathic medicine in a very winding path, and I would not change anything about it. I've always been interested in health and wellness and medicine, but never felt called to the conventional world. There's just something about the conventional paradigm that just never aligned with me. But I really did value higher education, and I kept looking for kind of something in the alternative space that had a higher education degree, and I just couldn't find it. And I settled at the time on physical therapy, and I did some prerequisites to go to PT school, and I actually was a PT aide for 2 years, and I'm really grateful that I did that because I realized that physical therapy is not what I wanted to do. I think I was enamored by the idea of healing with your hands and you know, keeping people from needing surgery or helping them heal post-surgery. But I wanted something more all-encompassing of health. And when I went back to the search for something in the alternative space that had a higher level of education, I came across naturopathic medicine. It had never crossed my radar before. And when I read this description, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is it. And I really took the time to do my due diligence. You know, I had read the pros and cons about it. I had read, you know, skeptics, you know, call it quackery and all these things. And I really went to these schools and talked to students and really tried to understand what it really was. And I liked what I saw. And so I ended up at Best Ear in Seattle, which is, I think, one of the larger ND medical schools out there. And I remember when I first got there, I was like, all right, if this is BS, if anything seems off, like I am just quitting, I'm going back. I was actually had a finance job at the time, and that never happened. I really enjoyed my time and my education there. I think it's a lot more conventional than people realize. You have to understand the standards of care in order to know when to deviate from them and when it's appropriate to do so. So I really enjoyed my time there. But Seattle itself, although it's beautiful, and we were just chatting about how beautiful the nature is up in the Pacific Northwest, it was not entirely for me. And I'd previously lived in San Francisco, but I just was ready for a fresh start. I knew I wanted to come back to California, and I just decided on LA as just a new, completely new experience. I didn't have any connections here. And so, yeah, I made the move here on my own and ended up opening up my own practice. And that's where I am now.
Thank you so much for sharing. We're really happy to have you here in LA. So what are some of your foundations to health and healing?
Well, one thing I will say that I love about naturopathic medicine is it works from a therapeutic order. There's like a literal triangle, and at the bottom are the foundations of health. And I think for all of us, for most of us, that's, you know, adequate sleep, nutrition, stress factors, movement. And then above that, you might do like nutraceutical things. And above that might be botanical medicine. And then you might have pharmaceuticals, and then you have surgeries. So we're trained to basically assess a patient and where can we safely start on this therapeutic order. We always want to be working on those foundations of health. So whenever I speak with patients, and the other highlight of my job and this profession is that I have at least 60 minutes with a patient so I can really dive into all these factors of, and that's what I think enables the medicine to shine, is just that therapeutic relationship, that patient relationship, and really understanding where they're coming to us from. And with that, we can really deliver just a little bit more sustainable medicine. So in my intake, and I love doing an extensive intake, I love just figuring out like all these pieces to the person in front of me. But I am asking about sleep. I am asking about diet. I am asking about movement. And one of the biggest things that I ask about is what their biggest stressors are, but also what brings them joy. It's very obvious to me, the more I work with patients, is that when they don't have those fun aspects to life, or they aren't, you know, engaging often enough with the things that they really do like, that's when some physical ailments can start to creep in. So I'm just really assessing just that whole person. But then from that, I'm also determining, well, are they a candidate like to just start at the foundations, or do we need to do a higher force intervention? Do they need the botanicals? Do they need a pharmaceutical? And so it's just taking that complete picture and then assessing it within that therapeutic order. And that's how, you know, I approach every patient interaction.
I was just recently listening to a podcast by Gabor Mate. He's an MD. Oh, yes. Yeah.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. And he was talking about how like he was trained allopathically, but has since like veered a little bit from the allopathic training. And he was talking about like every time that he goes and gives a speech and asks someone, have they seen their cardiologist or their neurologist? So heart doctor, brain doctor, do they ask you about stress and how your relationships are? And nobody kept their hand raised.
Yeah.
But it also is so hard because in that time, like we're pushed to see as many patients as we can. So even in my training and residency, as much as I would love to sit down with a patient and like ask them all of these foundational questions, like what brings you joy or what are your relationships like, we're so pressed for time. It's so hard to do, but that is so necessary for health. It's like what you said, foundational.
Yeah. And I will say, I mean, that's what I saw that I didn't want to go into the, you know, conventional paradigm, because you don't really get that, that breadth of, you know, interactions with your patients. But I know you all would probably love to do that. It's just insurance to me has really kind of ruined the medical system in a way, because you have to see so many patients in order to, you know, really make a living, unfortunately. So I really fault not necessarily your profession, but the insurance industry is from my perspective for that.
I completely agree. It's run too much like a business, because all of the physicians that I work with are like amazing and know that there's more that we can say and do in a visit, but sometimes we just can't. But you did mention nutraceutical versus botanicals, which I actually didn't know there was a difference. Do you mind explaining to us like what the difference is and some examples of a nutraceutical or a botanical?
Yeah. So I view nutraceuticals as like an extra physiological dose of a specific nutrient. So like vitamin C, right? You could get vitamin C adequately from the diet, but maybe if you want to treat a cold or like an early illness, you want to hit the system hard with more vitamin C than you can get in the diet. So that's what I term nutraceuticals, or just super concentrated ingredients. For botanicals, that's just to me extracts of the plant chemicals from plants, obviously. So I do think they're very different. And then obviously you have some combination of products that have both botanicals and nutraceuticals, but yeah, that's how I would delineate the two.
Thank you for explaining that. And can you give us some examples, like let's say a patient comes to you who has like a little bit more anxiety than they're used to experiencing, which seems to be kind of across the board the last couple of years. So what are some nutraceuticals or botanicals, maybe starting with nutraceuticals, that you usually recommend that could help people like that act as anxiolytics or can decrease anxiety?
Yeah, that's the great term. We call Vinny botanicals anxiolytics. From a nutraceutical standpoint, there are lots of combination products with like L-theanine and GABA, magnolia bark. Like there are known nutrients that can help kind of slow that part of our nervous system that is a little more revved up. So it actually kind of puts the brake on that part of our nervous system. Same thing with some botanicals. So lavender has actually largely been studied for anxiety. You could use it as aromatherapy, but and I'll make this caution that, you know, you should never really be ingesting essential oils without guidance or without a specific dose like made on a product. But there are doses of like lavender essential oil capsules that have been, you know, studied in smaller trials, but that do have benefit for anxiety too. And there's like a host of other botanicals that work that way. And I think the beauty of an extensive botanical medicine training is if you get to know your patient well enough, you can kind of match the right botanical for them. And same thing with some of the nutraceuticals, but there are a lot of products out there that can really help, especially before sleep. If you can, you know, take that to help calm you before bed, a lot of people, you know, have their mind running and they can't get to sleep. So many of my patients, unfortunately, you know, suffer from that. But if you can just start with a nutraceutical or a botanical rather than going to, you know, a higher intervention sleep aid, a lot of patients can avoid those prescriptions by using some of those agents.
So something else I wanted to ask you about specifically when you mentioned like lavender extract. So pharmaceuticals specifically go through like FDA approval, and a lot of like supplements and maybe essential oils don't go through the same like rigorous process. So how do we know that we're getting like pure essential oils or supplements or nutraceuticals that aren't like injected with any other types of chemicals?
I understand that that completely. And that's why like myself and just colleagues who use these therapeutics often, like we have trusted brands we go to. We don't like purchasing things off of Amazon. We usually get it directly from these people, or we use trusted third-party sites that we know are getting directly from manufacturers and are storing them properly and aren't tampering with them. That being said, I do think there are aspects of the supplement industry that are more regulated than people think. No, they might not be FDA approved, but these places still need to be practicing or should be practicing good manufacturing practices, GMPs. And a reputable and good pharmaceutical company will be doing that, and they'll be batch testing. And so all of the companies that I use, like they'll batch test and they're continually checking to make sure that there's no contaminants and that the amounts of substance that are in there are in there. And it's just about knowing, you know, those companies that do that. Normally there might be like a little certification that you can look at for some of them. And yeah, it's really just going with reputable companies. And that's where kind of working with a practitioner who's knowledgeable about it can help guide you to those.
Yeah, thank you. That's super helpful. And something that I recently learned is like third-party testing for all of those things is something that you can like start with. And that's kind of easier for us when we're looking for those products to sift through.
Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. So I know that you focus a lot on the mental and physical interaction. So how mental health affects physical health and physical health affects mental health. Do you mind going into a little bit more about how you came across this or why you started focusing on this and really what your focus is?
Yeah, when I first started working with patients, because I'm able to have such an in-depth conversation with them, I started putting things together. And it's not, I mean, this is actually common knowledge if you go and seek it out, but really a lot of people's problems started with some sort of traumatic or stressful event, or they're just super stressed themselves. And that's when a lot of their physical problems presented for them. It's really not hard to put two and two together. It's just that I think in regular medicine, we're not asking those questions. So we're not making that connection, but it has just become undeniable to me that our emotional state influences our physical state. And that is why I ask those questions about stress management, support, joy, all of it. But it's also the hardest thing to change sometimes. But what I try to do with my patients is just drop that seed of knowledge. Like, hey, there's a connection here. Pay attention to it. And then when patients are ready for it, I give them tools to kind of tackle it. Not everybody's ready to tackle those stressful things in their life. Not everyone's ready to tackle those big traumas in their life or even small traumas. But I just want them to be aware of it. And eventually they do become aware of it. But I haven't met like an autoimmune patient, like a fibromyalgia patient, like many classes of patients that don't come with a significant trauma or event in their earlier life that to me has really caused and is like a bigger, like the bigger reason behind their physical problems. And it's really hard to, for some people to accept that, but a lot of my patients, I think they get it after a while. And that's all you want to do is just drop the knowledge. And then when you're ready, you'll go work on that aspect of your health.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. And like you said, sometimes we miss that in medical practices, the mind-body connection.
Yeah.
And I'm on my behavioral health rotation right now. And something that one of the docs was talking to me about, he was saying that in our society now too, some people don't even know what their emotions are because as they were growing up, we've lived in this society where we don't really talk about our emotions sometimes. And so we don't even know how to tap into that. Like we were never asked like, how are you doing? And not just like, oh, fine, but really digging into our emotions. So we don't even have that like circuit in our brains to process like what are the emotions that we're feeling. And so it might take a while for people to have these like emotional underpinnings to actually like address them because we don't even know where they're coming from or we can't name them.
It's a huge cultural problem. I think maybe we're starting to wake up to it, but it's definitely not happening enough. So what happens is when you don't deal with those processes, the unconscious parts of your brain do. And your brain is what's running your entire system. And so instead of maybe perceiving, you know, when we were cavemen, like, you know, a bear or a lion or something running after you as threats, we perceive little things in our environment as threats. And that stress response starts in our body. But sometimes it happens subconsciously. You don't even realize that your body's having that response. And to your point about, you know, not feeling emotions, I was working indirectly with a patient, you know, giving her some IV therapies who was just miserable every day, body pain. And I started talking to her, I was giving her this therapy and I said, well, you know, what are you doing to support yourself emotionally? And she's like, oh, I don't feel emotions. I haven't felt emotions in years. And I pointed out, I was like, well, don't you see that your body's feeling that for you? Like she can't feel emotions, but her body is aching and is in such agony and pain because it's feeling the emotions she can't feel for her. And I told her straight up, I'm like, this therapy is not going to help you. Like what will help you is you actually finding a way to access those deep emotions that you cut yourself off from for X, Y, and Z reason. And she wasn't ready to hear that. And that's okay. I hope I planted that seed, but that's what I'm talking about. And that our body always is telling us something and it knows more than we know consciously. There's so many processes going on unconsciously. And that's why things like meditation are helpful and things where we can kind of tap into those deeper levels of ourselves. I think that's a reason why they're so beneficial. But you know, I'm a human on this earth too. It's really hard to focus on the self these days. And that's why you really have to make a conscious effort for it. And that's just what I try to, again, plant that seed for my patients, but I never force them to do it. You're never going to do it until you're ready. But it's an undeniable connection. And I do see that being a larger part of my practice is tackling kind of the emotional state. While I support the physical, but I know that the emotional state is what's really going to heal them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading The Secret Teachings of Plants, and but it's like the first half of the book is very scientific. The second half is a little bit more poetic. And what he said too is that we have both the heart and the mind, and that our heart actually responds quicker than our brain does if you're doing like electromagnetic, like EMG on your brain or an EKG on your heart. So the electric stimulation that your heart produces or your brain produces, and your heart actually responds to external stimuli quicker than your brain does. And he said that we've over intellectualized everything and have really stopped like listening to our heart. And so I think that has some aspect of what you're talking about is we've really lost our intuition and our innate ability to listen to our bodies, and it's all intellectualized. I'm at fault for that. I intellectualize a lot of things. It's one of the coping mechanisms, but we really have lost our ability to like feel what's going on inside of us.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned meditation as a tool. What are some other tools that you have that some of our listeners could use, or that you give your patients for helping heal the emotional state?
Yeah, the thing is, it's a different path for everyone. And what resonates with one person might not resonate for another. And I think that's the hardest part, because somebody will be like, oh, I tried meditation, it didn't work for me. Well, that is just a tool that didn't work for you, but there are other things to try. And a meditation could be for, somebody sitting down and just being silent for, 5 minutes to an hour. It could be listening to music for somebody. It could be just taking a walk out in nature. It could be reading. I mean, you just have to find kind of what works for you. But I do always encourage patients, first and foremost, the cheapest form of any help for your nervous system is to go outside, to be outside more and to go for a walk. If you can fit that in your day or even during your lunch break or something, that's just one of the simplest and, again, free things that you can do. And for meditation wise, I mean, this is something I'm trying to work on, but it doesn't always work for me. But I will try to do breath work instead of just sitting there and just letting thoughts run through my mind, which is meditation, by the way. There's no right or wrong way to do it. You just practice and you eventually get better. I will work on breath work where I breathe in for maybe a count of 4 or 5, hold it for 4 breaths, and then breathe out for 4 to 6 breaths or something. Breath work can regulate our nervous system so well. And it's, again, another simple free tool. So sometimes I'll give people like a breath work exercises to do. There's also biofeedback, which is similar to that, where you actually have, you go somewhere, but you have basically like sensors on you that are sensing your heart rate and maybe your breath rate. And you get to see what's happening while you are watching maybe something calming, and you get to see yourself self-regulating. And that kind of teaches you to pay attention more to the state of your body, and that you can bring that out into the real world. Neurofeedback is similar, although like uses kind of like
electrodes.
Yeah. So it might be a little weird for people, but there are stimulations to the brain, and then you get to feel and witness the feedback of your system relaxing as well. So a lot of it's just becoming aware. Some of my patients, I just have them journal or free write for like 10 minutes, like set the timer for 10 minutes, write whatever comes out, but just don't stop writing. You could be saying like, the sky is blue, the grass is green, but you just keep writing and writing and writing. And sometimes something just comes out because you're not trying to control it, and it just comes out. And then of course, just journaling in general. But those are just some of the like the simple tools that I'll give patients. Or just dancing, like go and dance, go put on a, music and dance to something just to get you out of your funk or whatever mood you're in just for a moment. But the sitting in silence, I will say, now that I just said all those things, is the hardest thing to do, but I think also the quickest way to get to what is inside of us, because I do honestly believe that we have the answers to whatever our questions are in our mind, or what we want to do next, or what are we feeling? And a lot of us don't sit with ourselves enough. But that's just the harder thing to do. So that's why I'll give all these other tools. But I think the main thing is if you can get to a point where you can sit with yourself at some point, that's probably will offer you the most information and time. I also think not enough people are getting therapeutic touch. So sometimes for some of, especially my trauma patients, I will recommend something called somatic experiencing therapy, or even visceral manipulation, just gentle movements to the body to release areas of tension and pain, but also maybe while working through some traumatic things, and especially for like sexual trauma patients or something. I mean, there's such an emotional release when you like hit a point of the body that might've been storing emotions that you weren't aware of that was the cause, but there's just going to be a really beautiful container for some mind body therapies like that, and actual therapeutic touch. I'll put acupuncture in there too, as kind of a relaxation tools, but you really have to find your own way. And that's why I kind of just give a bunch of things to people. And I'm like, choose what you want to try first or what resonates with you, and then go for it. So those are kind of the basic tools that sometimes I'll give my patients to explore.
That's really optimistic how many tools you have to offer, because so like you said,
well, I wish I could do them all. Like, I wish I could offer them all, but all I can do is make those referrals, but at least I have options for them, rather than just, you know, a medication or just deal with it. And I don't think medications are bad at all. It's just sometimes I have patients who don't want to be on them or don't even want to try them, or they want to try to get off of them. And these tools are available, but you have to be willing to try them, and you have to be able to give them a fair chance and deal with what comes up as it comes up. And not everybody's ready for that.
Yeah. And that leads us to the question regarding ketamine. I know that you recently brought that into your toolbox. And so do you mind describing what ketamine is, for what kinds of patients it'd be useful for, and how you've been using it?
Yeah. So I'm a big proponent of any like psychedelic therapy. I think it has such a profound effect on just rewiring our brains. And we talk about how we just get into these thought patterns. And sometimes you just need something to really experience something to really kind of shake that up and get things to change. And I do find that psychedelics do offer that, but they are not, you know, they're being investigated, but it's not a legal avenue for me to go down or suggest to patients, but I am in support of it. And so when I heard about ketamine, it has a similar effect. It has its own type of effect, but it's a similar effect. And it's legal, and we can legally use it. Not only is it legal, but instead of being on some 4 to 6 to 8 hour journey, you can get relief within like one session that's over in an hour. So it's more practical, I think. And you know, when I first heard about it, it was because I was working with this DO who just brought into the practice without any training or without any protocols. And I just thought it was irresponsible and crazy. So I actually went and started doing research on it. And when I researched it, I was very impressed with the literature. I was very impressed with the safety profile of ketamine, enough so that I was like, okay, I'm going to try this on myself. And I personally learned the most from ketamine doing it myself. And I think that's very valuable to my patients, because I know what they're going through. I know what the experience is like. I've been able to curate an experience that I think is, you know, potentially more comfortable for them than if they were to go to some other places, because they really understand it. And I've been to all of these various places that ketamine can take you. But similar to all the investigations going on into other psychedelics, there are properties that in the use of ketamine and what it does in the brain that can increase neuroplasticity and can actually increase neuron growth. One of the theories behind depression and some other like mental health diagnoses is that there is maybe a loss of neuron connections and loss of synapses, and so loss of communication, therefore, you know, maybe loss of neurotransmitter production. And so these substances can influence the brain to actually regenerate and make new networks. And there is a biochemical therapeutic benefit from that's emerging. We don't fully understand everything, but to me, the kind of psychotropic effect of it has its own part in the healing process too. When you know, experience things that aren't of this reality as you know it, it makes you think, it makes you pause. It's a really beautiful experience for some patients. It just has so many unique positive consequences, I'll say. There are just so many factors that I think can be beneficial to somebody who is needing to get off the hamster wheel of their mind, or, you know, has a diagnosis that they don't want to use medication for, or that the medication's not helping them for. And so I should back up and say that treatment resistant depression is the largest use of ketamine right now that's being investigated, with some really outstanding results, especially suicidal patients. And I don't work with the suicidal population. That's not appropriate for me to do. You know, I think you should really work with a psychiatrist in that setting. But I do work with patients with depression, and within 1, 2 to 3 to 4 sessions, all of a sudden their depression's lifted and they're seeing their day-to-day life from a different perspective. And that's something that either medication can never do for them, or just the onset's much quicker than some medications, which might take months to help them. So there's really profound things going on. We don't fully understand everything that it's doing in the brain, but everything we have found is positive. So that's kind of a little bit of a tangent there on ketamine, but I do find it a really beautiful tool that's appropriate for a large number of people, to be quite honest with you. But the most of the studies are for depression, and they're starting to emerge for things like OCD and anxiety, which often go hand in hand with depression at times.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that, because like you mentioned, you have this like wide variety of tools, and that's just another one of the tools that we could potentially use for folks who are experiencing mental health problems. And there's not a great amount of tools and therapies that we have for that. So anything that could potentially help is exciting. And I'm really excited to see where those studies go.
And I didn't really dive in too much in terms of what ketamine is. I think most people might be familiar with it either as a street drug, which it does exist as a street drug, or a horse tranquilizer, or the anesthetic that it is used still to this day. So yes, it is all of those things, but when used, you know, appropriately in the appropriate setting, and at sub anesthetic doses, it is a substance that does have these psychotropic effects. And I just think it's a wonderful tool right now as we're starting to open up to kind of these more psychedelic type therapies as answers to a lot of mental illness problems.
And do you mind explaining what sub-anesthetic means?
Yeah, so just doses not used to put you, you know, asleep or under. So we're talking at least 4 to 6 times less of an amount that we would use to just impart this experience. And we're not like putting you to sleep. Like I think the cool thing about ketamine is your brain is very much still with it. You can talk, you can communicate with me, although the journey is very much an inward one. But you still have this functionality while you also are just undergoing this very interesting experience. But it is an anesthetic, but safe enough that it's usually preferred for pregnant women and children, and it exits the body very quickly too, which is another thing that I like about it, is people recover from it really, really well and quite quickly.
And I was wondering, how open are people to the use of ketamine? Is it becoming more widely accepted? Are there like specific people who seek you out or seek ketamine treatment out? Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, I think here in LA, I think it's definitely everywhere in a sense, or people are definitely more open to it here. Most people that I broach the subject with are open to it. And sometimes I have patients talk about it and then I say, well, I offer that here too. And they're like, oh, I didn't know that. And because, you know, they trust me, they prefer to have it done by me than maybe where they were going to go. But I think there are some people hesitant about it because of kind of the negative connotation that ketamine has as a street drug. And, you know, the whole notion that drugs are bad or like a psychedelic experience might be bad. And that's such an unfortunate like consequence, in my opinion, from kind of the war on drugs that we waged in the 70s. I think that did a disservice to us in many ways. But yeah, there's a lot of hesitation for some people around that. And I just have to explain to them, you know, the safety profile and that in the context it's being used, because context matters. Like I'm somebody who I don't ever really think the drug's the problem. It's just the context in which it's used. So yeah, in a clinical setting, in a controlled setting, people feel safer with it. I often sit in with sessions too. If patients, you know, feel they need that support. I'm also very partial to IV administration versus some clinics are just doing the shots into the muscle, which are effective. But if for a patient who wants a sense of control and wants to be able to know that they can stop it if they want, you can't backpedal with that if you do the shot. So I think doing it in an IV in a clinical setting gives people that sense of control and takes away kind of that scariness that maybe doing a drug to them would otherwise have. And honestly, there are few contraindications to who might be eligible for ketamine. You know, we largely do want to use it for people who are depressed, but I am of the mindset that it can be beneficial for really anybody. You don't need to have depression, but it is an off-label use of ketamine. And, you know, I think some people are practicing in more of a safe way and just only using it for depression, just because that's where the most studies are in regard to it. but it worked. It's compatible with many medications. So even if you're on like an SSRI or SSNRI, you can still use this medication. There's really few contraindications to it. The big red flags would be if, you know, you are an active ketamine user recreationally and abusing it that way. If you have, you know, active psychosis or history of active psychosis, I would caution use of that. If you are bipolar, especially bipolar one and experiencing mania, this is not a therapy for you. And those are really the main ones. Also, if you have like a cardiovascular disease or like a stroke risk or uncontrolled high blood pressure, that would be another contraindication or a therapy not to start until that those things are under control. But I've administered ketamine to like a guy in his 80s, you know, and it's really, and he was on a number of medications and he got his echo done and he was all cleared, but it's really, I think that's the other beauty of it is it's a really compatible tool for a lot of people, no matter kind of what state they're in. A lot of mental health clinics are just focused on the mind and the, you know, the mental aspect. You have a whole body to support as well. And I think that's where I also feel grateful in that, you know, we know that a less diverse microbiome is associated with depression. Like we've found these correlations of, you know, gut health and other aspects of health that are tied into the mental aspect. And, you know, what begins what is maybe a question, but we also need to support the body. And I do find that not necessarily being paid attention to enough. Like, yes, ketamine is great. Yes, like any pharmaceutical might be an option for you, or yes, a nutraceutical or a botanical might be, but we also have to at some point like address the physical body as well, because the two go hand in hand.
Amen. I recently had Dr. Ellen Vora on. She is like a holistic psychiatrist. She's based out of New York. And she was talking about how like before we used to be so focused on the physical body. Now we're finally thinking about mental health things. But also people are getting so focused on mental health, we keep forgetting about the physical body. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, it's nothing is disconnected. It's all one.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. And she brings that into her practice too, because she is very much about like the mind-body connection.
It's great.
Yeah. So lastly, we ask all of our guests to finish the following sentence. The future is blank.
I just want to say, and it sounds so cliche, but it's really whatever you make it. I think what I'm learning for myself and as I work with more patients is like, you have the answers. Like the answer to whatever you want in life is you. And if you want a better future and if you want better health, it really starts with you. And it's the easiest answer, but it's also the hardest, because we are just not in a society or culture that's conducive to paying attention to our wants and our needs in that way, or the subtleties of what our body is telling us, or feeling like we have control. There's also just a lot of like victimology, kind of, I don't even know if it's a word, but there's just a lot of, you know, blaming on other things or just being like, oh, this happened to me, and just sitting in that. And I think it's fine to experience, you know, all of those things, but at some point, like you're the only one that can turn things around. And I think there are too many of us, and you know, I've been this person, I still am this person sometimes, that, you know, put our happiness or put our health on other people. And so whatever you want in the future, like, it's up to you. It's sometimes the hardest pill to swallow, but the answer is you. And I just find that more and more as like I live life and work with patients. So I think the future can be bright. I think the future can be whatever you want it to be. But it starts with, you know, you making the difference with you. So that's my answer to that. It's kind of esoteric, but it's just, again, a truth that just keeps coming up for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Bull, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Yeah, I appreciate the invitation. I had a great time. And thank you very much for having me on.
The opinions expressed on this show are those of the Nuance and Medicine Explained and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of their places of employment. The opinions expressed on this podcast are meant for entertainment and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified board-certified practicing clinician.